Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Caroline Baum. This session is called Real Food. Gay, I read something that you wrote in an essay about the fact that the first thing that you remember cooking was when you were 11 years old, you made some cream puffs. And you were quite pleased with your cream puffs, and you were quite pleased with the praise that you got for cream puffs. And also it sort of set you on a course of being intrigued by the making of pastry. So would you like to say something about cream puffs? And then I'm going to ask each of the other two of you, what is the first thing that you actually remember cooking?
No, I don't have much to say about cream puffs, although I've made quite a few cream puffs in my life. And I think they're a rather magical kind of pastry, sort of swelling pastry with apparently very little done by herself and all the work being done by the gluten in the flour and the moisture. The point of telling that story about cream puffs was I grew up in a house where food wasn't important. My mother was a truly hopeless cook. She had absolutely no interest in cooking whatsoever. In fact, her pièce de résistance was early watermelon, which I... Has anyone heard of early watermelon? It was a woman's weekly recipe, and you need a glass bowl, preferably one on a stem, quite a big glass bowl, and you build a slice of watermelon from flummery and passion fruit seeds and green jello and powder custard. Very important to use powder custard. But I don't judge her for being a bad cook. I think it's perfectly okay to be a bad cook. The point about the cream puff story was that, and I have seen enough of Charlotte's marvellous book, to see that she actually quotes a little bit from Plenty, where I say what I absolutely fell for was the praise that people gave me, even though the cream puffs were appalling.
Well, that segues nicely to you, Charlotte. So can you remember what the first thing that you cooked was and whether it was a triumph or was it a disaster?
I'm sure it was a disaster. I can't remember what it was, although I think I made one thing as a child, which was a cinnamon tea cake, which was fine, but I didn't like cooking. And I clearly didn't get enough praise, I think, is the problem. I only really learned to love cooking when I was in my 20s. But my sister, my older sister, was a wonderful cook. And I think I sort of left it to her to make the pastry and the scones and get the praise.
Because I think the other thing that you two, of course, have in common that Gay raised there is this thing about having a mother who's not the most brilliant of cooks. And you talk about the fact that from your mother's point of view, being the head of a family of five, for her, it was a real chore.
Yeah, my mother was a very competent cook. But in my book, I talk about how she, you know, she didn't love to cook, and nor would I if I had been her with five children to feed every day. And I'm quite ashamed of how much we grumbled and whined about the food that she made, which was really healthy food. She grew a lot of our vegetables. They had very little money, my parents. So I think it was sort of drudgery for her. And her real love was the garden. And I think, you know, and that's where she could be creative and have a kind of vision and make something. That was where her love lay. And the provision of food was a job that she did, you know, with absolutely no complaint, but no real pleasure, I think.
Can I just quickly say something before you
please
go to Mungo? A few years ago, I did some very loose and friendly oral histories with many immigrant groups of women, most of them in their 70s, because of a very big project I directed in Melbourne called Eating the City, where these groups of people made parts of an enormous table, an 80 square metre table, where they built the city to scale out of food three-dimensionally. It was a huge public event funded by the City of Melbourne, which has a fantastic community development section and also has lots of money. Anyway, the oral history was fascinating, and one of the groups of women, not immigrant, except from a long time ago, was the Country Women's Association. And it was fantastic talking to them at their very grand house in Toorak. All the women said of their husband, when I asked if their husbands were good cooks, they all said, "He is a good plain cook." And I went away scratching my head, thinking, what is it exactly they're saying about him? And I suddenly realised that they were saying, he can cook a roast, he can cook a meal, but he doesn't make fancy things like cakes and biscuits and scones and things like that.
Well, that, in fact, is leads perfectly then on to Mungo, because at the beginning of your new book, Eat My Words, you talk about the sort of history of food in Australia. So what about your personal history and the kind of food that you grew up with?
Well, being much the same generation, it was much the same sort of food, and what Gay would call, no doubt, good plain cooking. And when I use the word good fairly loosely, it was certainly plain, and almost all of it was cooking, almost all of it was overcooking, which was again a sign of the times, I think. I've never been certain whether my parents were afraid of high datives or they simply never took stuff out of the oven in time. But it wasn't what you'd call a gourmet household by any means. And when I was asked the other day what was the worst meal I'd ever eaten, I declined to answer on the grounds that I did not want to impugn the memory of my beloved mother. My own early cooking experience, of course, was confined largely to sweets, as I think a lot of children's was in those days. I was taught to make coconut ice and Russian toffee and chocolate fudge, lots of things with lots and lots of sugar, which I enjoyed greatly until about the age of 15, when I took up smoking instead.
Gay, you've just moved to this area from South Australia. You lived in a very abundant, very plentiful area in South Australia, in Wollongong, which has a very beautiful food market, in the middle of all those lovely almond groves and people also making wine, of course, and olive oil. And you've only been here a matter of months. So have you established a kind of food map for yourself in terms of produce and shops and suppliers? And have you established a new kind of rhythm to go with your new life here?
No. The first thing I did discover, a couple of things I've discovered. The salumi made at Billy Nudgell, I think, is of absolutely fantastic quality. it's everything a salami should be, I think. Not a ground mince put into a casing, not oversalted. It has a wonderful, hefty, dry feeling to it. Good large pieces of fat. I just want to say I think it's a fantastic product. If I find nothing else up here, that will do, really. I've also found some good cheese, but that's not to say it's local cheese. And I'm a great lover of hard cheeses, not soft cheeses. So, in fact, the good hard cheese I found and the good blue, the other thing I really love, all comes from overseas. And if we ever did get to talk about the local as opposed to what isn't local and what comes across in an aeroplane, I think it's okay to choose what you really love from somewhere else and eat it in moderation.
Well,
even with gusto.
No, with gusto in moderation.
Let me ask you, Mungo, as someone who's a local of long standing, you now have an opportunity to introduce Gay to one ingredient that she may not have come across yet, or one producer or supplier that you think she should know about.
For starters, I think you should frequent the Brunswick Heads Fish Co-op vigorously and frequently. The farmers' markets, of course, are all, you know, very reasonable local produce, as farmers' markets are. And the greengrocers on the whole around the Mullumbimby Brunswick Heads area do stock local produce. It's not all brought from the Brisbane markets. So you've got all those things. There's a nice good bread maker at Newry Bar. There's a very good butcher at Bex Hill. What else can I say? But as with everywhere, once you move in, you find the places for yourself and you make the contacts for yourself. But it is, by and large, there's not much you can't get here. You've mentioned hard cheese, that's one thing. Berry fruit has to, by and large, be brought down from the hills, but not too far. And some of the more expensive, you don't get a lot of caviar here. But there's not much you can't get, and that's one of the great advantages of living here. I find we're on a crossover climate area between temperate and subtropical, which means just about anything grows here and grows here pretty well.
Mm. Charlotte, you live in inner city Sydney. Can you talk a little bit about the way that you shop for food, and can you talk particularly perhaps about the ingredient of trust? Because it seems to me that trust has become a much more important part of the way we think about the food that we buy. And that also leads into your investigation in Love and Hunger of the more sort of ethical issues surrounding what you choose to eat.
Yes, I live in Marrickville in Sydney, which is a fantastic suburb, actually. It's been a suburb housing waves of migrants over the years, which I think 20 years ago and 30 years ago were Greek and then Vietnamese. Now people like me are moving in and gentrifying, but lots of Middle Eastern people. We have a regular farmers market a 10-minute walk from my house every Sunday, which is fantastic, at Addison Road, which is a community centre. So it's sort of Sydney basin produce. I have become interested in where to get meat particularly, because as an enthusiastic meat eater, I am very conflicted about my enthusiasm for eating meat. And the way that I kind of manage my conscience about that is to try and certainly cook with meat that I know has been raised, you know, as humanely as possible and as environmentally sustainably as possible, etc. So I buy my meat through some people called Feather and Bone, who are a kind of broker for producers, and they go and visit the farms and they have a very strong relationship with the producers, and they consider the animal in the scheme of, you know, environmentally how the farm's been managed, etc., etc. But I'm kind of worried about the kind of fakery that is starting to happen with free range and organic, etc., because I think there are a lot of people like me who do care about it, but as soon as someone tells them it's free range or organic, you go, oh good, and you just buy it and you don't actually know. And because of my relationship has developed with people at Feather and Bone, I know how much is involved and how, for example, one so-called, you know, ethical butcher that I know of in Sydney has been saying that they're getting pork from one farm, which is not the case, apparently. So it's sort of, I think it's the next wave of, you know, ethics in food consumption is to actually start to label things properly. And there's the whole free-range egg and chicken debate that everybody knows about, what the definitions are and the stocking rates and all that kind of stuff. So it can become very confusing. Well, I think it's very confusing for most normal people. Mm. I mean, for someone like me who thinks about food at least probably 8 hours a day, it's interesting and it's easier. But for people like my sisters who have a few kids and live near a supermarket, that's where they do all their shopping, and it's not really even a part of their lives at the moment.
Mungo, would you like to respond to that? I saw that was something you...
just like to say something about organic, which I think's one of the most misused and overused and misleading words in the vocabulary at the moment. I mean, by far the most organic thing you buy on a daily basis is the petrol you put in your car, which is not exactly what presumably you want your chooks and meat raised on. I mean, organic's a nothing word. If it's meant to mean free of chemical fertilisers, it isn't. All fertilisers are chemicals by definition, and not only are they all chemicals, they're interchangeable chemicals. I mean, a fertiliser like urea, which is the basis of almost all nitrogen-based fertilisers, can be made synthetically, it can be made out of chicken poo. You know, there is no formula for this, and there's no earthly reason to suppose one method's any better than the other. So this nonsense about, oh, I must eat organic, is precisely that. It's nonsense. There's no such thing as inorganic food. No, what do you reckon you're eating? Steel and bricks.
I was hoping we'd get a bit of controversy going, and there was another point at which I thought this would happen, but it's happened now. Gay, go.
Well, there's no such thing as unreal food either. So whatever we put into our mouth and ingest...
And
tofu. No, I'm coming to that.
I'm glad you brought that up, Mungo, because tofu is one of the great foods.
Yeah.
And Mungo disagrees.
I'm wondering if you're not just an unreconstructed left-leaning conservative, or you find it not chewy enough.
Well, actually, would you like to respond to that, Mungo? I have to let you respond to that.
I find it not foody enough. Tofu is fake food. It was, in fact, invented in the Han Dynasty of China, and it was invented by some smart PR consultant.
To feed a population of millions.
It was invented by, yes, as a cheap way of feeding a population of millions. This guy suddenly found that there was something you could do with the waste product after you'd made soy milk out of soybeans. The waste product was previously used as pig swill to the less discerning Chinese pigs. But this guy found that if you If you belted it down, you compressed it, you squeezed it out into bricks, it became a mildly useful source of vegetable protein, which could then be sold. And it was sold, and it's been marketed and flogged by everybody under the sun. It arrived in Australia originally as fish food extender. Do you remember in the old cheap fish shops, you could buy marinara mix, which contained these vivid orange pieces of crap? That was tofu. And it still is tofu. Tofu has no flavour of its own, but it's useful in soaking up the flavours of stuff round it.
Like the pasta and rice.
That doesn't make
like
it illegitimate.
Choco, for instance. It's on the same level as the choco.
Charlotte. Charlotte. No, Charlotte's turn. Okay, just wait a moment. Charlotte, I know that you disagree vehemently with Mungo.
Well, I think it's a very out-of-date attitude to tofu, I have to say. And to be very controversial, a little ignorant. To say that something that is an incredibly versatile, delicious, delicate, beautifully textured, silken, gorgeous thing as tofu
is. It's versatile because it's got no character of its own. It can only take on the characters of what's around it.
Do you eat pasta on its own with nothing else on it?
Occasionally, or with very little else, olive oil and garlic, perhaps.
Okay.
Mungo, I think you just don't like tofu.
But there's another.
I want to. I want to take us back to the butcher because I have a view of Australian cooking, which is that we, as it is now, which is that we have come to whatever we think food and cookery is. We've come from the top down, and somehow we've never really come to terms with the bottom up. So I think we have a very topsy, we, the middle class, I mean, have a very topsy-turvy relationship and knowledge of food. For instance, a wonderful young man who worked for me for a long time in the late 80s and 90s and then went on to have his own terrific restaurant in Sydney and who I still stay in touch with. His name is Leif Etourneau and he had a wonderful restaurant called Onzain in Sydney. No silly stuff, just good food. Leif now, instead of being a chef with his own restaurant, has gone to work for a butcher. And I think this sort of progression, if you want to call it progression, is about leaving the top down and beginning again at the bottom up.
Well, I think rather than having squabbles about tofu or that other very contentious ingredient that you rant about, Mungo, in Eat My Words, chorizo, which I know both of these women are great fans of, so we're not going to dwell on the chorizo issue.
Okay, well, just mention that I'm not a rant. I simply said that I do not think chorizo goes very well in a seafood paella.
The Spanish have been cooking for a lot longer than you.
The Spanish do, but the Spanish put paella out of whatever they've got left over.
What's wrong with leftovers?
Chorizo's fine in its place, but not in a seafood paella.
I want to draw a line under ingredients, you can see why, and I want to move to a slightly more philosophical kind of plane if we can. I wanted to talk a little bit about choice and simplicity because you said, Gay, in an essay, I ache for places where I know what I will eat because it is the only thing to eat. And I'm wondering whether you'd like to say something about maybe the fact that we're suffering from choice fatigue.
Yes, I think it's the ultimate courtesy to have your food chosen for you, not to have to make a choice, which emulates, in a sense, home cooking and gives true legitimacy to home cooking. I think this is part of what I began to talk about, the topsy-turvy nature of our middle-class attitude towards food in Australia, that it seems to be so misdirected towards public dining and professional cooks, when in fact real food is what we all make for ourselves every day. The quality of that real food is not the issue here.
No, and in fact that is the thing where you are, the three of you, are in actual harmony and agreement, and that is really the theme of all three of your books and writings. Charlotte, would you like to say something about that simplicity and choice fatigue?
Yes, I love what Gay says about not having a choice because you then enter into a relationship with the person who is offering you the food. And that my whole book is about home cooking and about that exchange of generosity and hospitality between people in their homes. And I think it was in one of your essays, Gay, you talked about the ideal restaurant being one where, that involved no commerce taking place. Mm. And I think one of the great joys of my life in cooking is in gathering people around a shared table with a shared plate, and that it's not kind of individual. You know, I have this thing, you have a completely different thing, you don't eat that, so you have, you know, something else. And so there's a kind of warmth and intimacy in the sharing of food that someone chooses for you. Mm. It also means that you might eat things that you wouldn't ordinarily choose, because if you have good manners, you don't refuse anything that is offered to you. Mm.
Can I respond to that, and in agreement, by reading you a very, very short part from a very, very tiny little book of mine.
It's a beautiful book.
Called On Digestion, because it addresses exactly the same thing as Charlotte is talking about, and because I think I write slightly better than I speak. In 1982, Jean-François Revel, admittedly a Frenchman addressing almost exclusively French gastronomy, closed Culture and Cuisine with the hypothesis that the predominant characteristic of contemporary gastronomy in these closing years of the 20th century appears to me to be obvious. For better or for worse, this predominant characteristic is the return to nature. Revel's conclusion is not a vote for noble savagery. His text is a historical exploration of two streams of cookery, silent cuisine and cuisine that talks too much, domestic and fancy. He sees a constant battle between the good amateur cook and the thinking chef, a lover's quarrel that, as in all adventure novels, ends after many a stormy scene with a marriage. The place where good digestion waits on appetite is one in which everyone, domestic or professional, who cooks with experience and knowledge particular to their kitchen and culture is equally valued. We've become transfixed by public commercial dining, as though these kitchens and dining rooms, and only these, might show us who we are. What does Australia digest? Would it not be interesting to include in the census form a question such as, what did you eat for breakfast and dinner yesterday?
Mungo, you wanted to respond on the question of choice and simplicity.
Yes, although I must very much agree with much of what Gay said in that. I love the idea of the simple restaurant. I mean, some of the best meals I've ever had in my life were driving through France and just stopping at the roadside restaurants for the plat du jour. There was only one thing on the menu. It was almost always lovely, and it certainly saved a lot of mucking around. But like so many good ideas, this has been perverted by commerce. So now when you go into a restaurant and somebody else chooses for you, exactly what you get is the fancy nonsense. You get the degustation meal. And I mean, this is a menu that is chosen for the chef to show off for no other reason at all. He couldn't give a damn what you think about the food. It's him or her showing off. So instead of getting this elegant simplicity, this splendid idea of sharing an experience between you with that home-cooked meal or that one-course plat du jour meal, you get bullied into submission with 100 different courses and are forced to retire to the vomitorium. I mean, this is not what we mean by real food.